Some years ago, no doubt smitten by sudden compulsion to a higher and nobler purpose, the editors of the Saturday Evening Post launched a series of articles known as Adventures of the Mind. Now, it was an identical urge on my own part, I suppose, that prompted me to purchase this particular sequence of posts and deposit them on a living room shelf where it could be seen by visitors I wanted to impress with my interest in intellectual pursuits. There they gathered dust for the next couple of years and ultimately went on that inevitable magazine adventure to a charity hospital in one of my good wife's urges to rid herself of my collections. Before they departed, however, I'd managed to venture through most of the adventures, and I'm prepared now to report that though the mind may adventure, it does not necessarily retain. From all the rather esoteric meanderings provided by this series, only one small but insightful side jaunt clings to mind and won't let go. It's Edith Hamilton, quoting William James in her essay, urging that we learn the lessons of the past. William James once said, "There are two subjects which, if mentioned, made other conversations stop and directed all eyes to the speaker. Religion was one, and education the other." At times, I've amused myself during dull parties by experimenting with this premise. It works. It even works when the subject of sex is bouncing around at a dormitory stag or gossip is fluttering across the dummy at bridge. Inject into almost any conversation either religion or education and the chit-chat stops. Somehow, the talk takes an abrupt veer, and if that's your purpose, you've got the audience. Now, the injection has to be subtle, it's true. In post-Christian scientific eras like this, when people no longer believe they need religion and therefore find it a bore, one has to suggest that maybe, after all, God is dead and Hugh Hefner's a prophet. The debate is good for the rest of the evening. In times when everyone knows that classrooms are irrelevant and the structured, soulless university is doomed, the wise conversation stopper will avoid the term education directly, but raise the issue obliquely by wondering aloud what that crowd was doing on the south portico of the Illini Union at noon, and why did it appear so terribly intense and concerned. Alas, even such devious devices as this have failed me the last couple of years when two other subjects are mentioned. These two subjects have so wedged themselves into our minds that usual conversation stoppers won't stop them. These two subjects wedded are the single topic assigned me today, the media and that war. Now, as if this were not sufficiently impossible task, it must be attacked at a time when the media are blamed for starting most wars, and when the particular war in question is of such a special nature that everyone understands when we refer to it simply as that war. Moreover, I'm asked to do this job when the nearest I've come to Vietnam is the immunization shots, which I got enough years ago to confirm that this is America's longest war, but I never made the trip. This makes me, I think, one of the few credentialed journalists who has spent no time in a Saigon bar and no expense money on a Hong Kong suit. At the time, and it was in the early days of the Kennedy administration, I was writing editorials for the Nashville Tennessean, and I was occasionally called upon when our specialist on this subject was off the job to solve the Southeast Asian situation over breakfast coffee. We're a morning newspaper. It seems there would have been some naval maneuvers out in the waters west of the Philippines and east of Vietnam, and ours was among the newspapers invited to send an observer. I'd taken one trip of this nature, the other an Air Force junket to Western Europe shortly before the Hungarian Revolution, and naturally I was anxious to become an old Asian hand as well as a NATO expert. It remains one of the painful disappointments of my life that maneuvers were canceled after my shots had already been taken. Due to a situation the State Department described at the time as certain tensions. We were informed that holding naval maneuvers in and around the Gulf of Tonkin in such circumstances might convey the mistaken impression that the U.S. had some interest in the internal affairs of Southeast Asia. My qualifications for discussing this topic, therefore, have to come to you sort of by proxy, and I hope you'll forgive me if this involves a little name and place dropping here and there. While I was in Harvard under Nieman Fellowship in 1962, there were within our group two young men who were there mainly because they'd been booted out of Vietnam. One of these was Nguyen Thai, a Vietnamese who had been head of the Vietnam Press Bureau until he became disillusioned with the policies of Jean. He allowed this to be reflected in his writing, it seems, and was shortly forced to flee the country. He wrote a book, Is South Vietnam Viable, which was published in November of that year in the Philippines. Besides many chats with him about politics in that area, I've read his book. The other was François Soulier, a Frenchman and correspondent for Newsweek magazine. His publisher, the late Philip Graham, arranged to have Soulier join our group after Jim had expelled him, too. Soulier had written something that incurred the wrath of Madame New and was likewise escorted into temporary retirement. As I was going over this material last week, I ran across an old index on Newsweek and found half a dozen articles by Francois in the first 6 months of 1964, articles on some junta shakeup and the Hamlet program and the Viet Cong spies, and then a later piece that came shortly behind on the failure of the Hamlet program. An article on a Cambodian border tour and so forth. These, of course, were written following his return to Vietnam and in the period immediately after the assassination of Jim and a few weeks later of President Kennedy. Well, it was interesting to be around fellows like Thai and Soulier, veterans of the French phase of the Vietnam affair in those days before even President Kennedy was much concerned with our involvement there. Laos was a far more pressing Asian preoccupation for him, and the big news that fall was that eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation in Cuba. Berlin was a subject of far greater dimension, particularly when the president declared himself a Berliner, and all of us in the media cheered. The wall, after all, was about our best propaganda stroke. Thai, a real political activist in the Oriental sense, was not inclined to let the Vietnam thing rest, however. He asked me to lunch at the faculty club one day and in the most conspiratorial tones sought advice on how to go about lobbying the American Congress to the view that Jim was a crook. He already perceived that the man couldn't last long without his Washington prop. Well, I told him, gee, I don't know. But it appeared to me that a young reporter friend of mine out in Vietnam at that time might convince the Congress himself. His name was David Halberstam, and he'd been with us in Nashville for 2 or 3 years before joining the New York Times. You've probably heard of David by now. He's currently with Harper's Magazine and recently had an excellent piece, Return to Vietnam, selected as one of the outstanding magazine articles of the year. David picked up a Pulitzer Prize reporting for the Times from Vietnam, and he later wrote a book about it entitled The Making of a Quagmire. Let me report here that the generation gap arrived early in American journalism, and like the more contemporary one, it centered on that war. Halberstam was sort of the storm eye, but he was not alone. Among the young reporters who challenged professional reporters of the time in reporting this kind of war were other such young newsmen as Neil Sheehan, then of the United Press International, now of the New York Times, who reported to our Nieman group that year. Malcolm Brown, Associated Press, great reporter, photographer. Brown, who likewise won a Pulitzer, and he's also now with the Times, is thoroughly familiar with revolutionary processes, and I warn you to pay attention to his current reporting from Latin America and South America. He also wrote a vivid volume about Vietnam, The New Face of War. One of our Nieman sessions that year was with a member of the older generation of reporters, sharply critical of Halberstam, Sheehan, Brown, and crew, one Joseph Alsop. After a trip of his own to Saigon, Alsop declared these young reporters off base in his rather elegant way. They were, he suggested, procuring their dispatches from certain Saigon watering holes and elbow-bending with junior officers, a charge singularly akin to one made by Madame New. Afterwards, Thai and Soulier hooted at Alsop's contentions, and they were hardly more civil to his face. He and others of his creaking generation, they charged, arrived in Saigon on my kind of junket, got the VIP tour, were wined and dined by Madame New at her palace, and then sent out to echo the line of Jim and the U.S. State Department. I believe George Romney called this brainwashing. A term he learned later to regret, and I do too now, and the closer it comes to November the 5th, the more I regret it. One can judge from the rhetoric, I suppose, here, which side I was on, but that wasn't my judgment alone. Bernard Fall, with whom we had a chance to speak briefly following his lecture on this campus in 1964-65, also felt that these young journalists and junior officers had the better part of a professional dispute, which still divides the SLA Marshall and the Hanson Baldwins from the Peter Arnetts and the Westmorelands from the ROTC grads. Fall, in a dozen magazine articles and three major books, Street Without Joy, The Two Vietnams, Hell in a Very Small Place, probably contributed more of substance to the Vietnam literature than any other single journalist before he was killed there last year. All these personalities and readings have not been tossed out to you now simply to impress you. That was part of it, but I want to make 3 points. First of all, considering the prints alone, when one speaks of the media's coverage of that war, he has to include, beyond mere daily newspapers, a spray of magazines of all shades and a great number of popularized and paperback books. It's very tough to generalize about such a broad band. Second, a stream of this literature, first as a trickle grown now to Niagara proportions, and containing almost every conceivable point of view from Ramparts to National Review, has been pouring out of Vietnam since the early days of American interest there. Third, and closely related, the media are not a monolith. Any grammarians here? I don't know how that goes. One can expect to get unanimity from the components of the media about as reasonably as Chancellor Pelson can answer that unanswerable question he says he's constantly asked. What does the university think about this? Well, so much for the nature of our nation's media, at least the prints, which will never be able to speak with one voice on Vietnam. Perhaps that circumstance is due beyond freedom to the very nature of war. A strange thing, war, and even before the strangest of all of them broke out, it had the best of journalists baffled. One of the finest who ever wrote of its fascinating horrors was the late A.J. Liebling, the New Yorker's great correspondent of World War II. In 1964, shortly before his death, the Liebling put together an anthology entitled Molly and Other War Pieces, and in the foreword gave us an insight into the strange ambivalence that tears at men's minds when subjects like war and violence arise. The wars were the central theme of my life, he writes, from October 1939 until the end of 1944, and I sometimes feel a deplorable nostalgia for them. The times were full of certainties. We could be certain we were right, and we were. And that certainty made us certain that anything we did was right, too. I have seldom been sure I was right since. I know that it is socially acceptable to write about war as an unmitigated terror and horror, but subjectively, at least, it was not true, and you can feel its pull on men's memories at the maudlin reunions of war divisions. They mourn for their dead, but also for war. This is to say, of course, that the most positive and exciting things that ever happened in the dull and rather humdrum lives of many Americans occurred during those days they associate with war. This same ambivalence is visible, I fear, in the other forms of violence our society currently encounters. Dr. John Paul Spiegel, head of the Lindbergh Center for the Study of Violence at Brandeis University, made note of this phenomenon when I interviewed him there this summer. There are 3 American views of violence, he claims, and one of these is that it is a legitimate means to bring about social revolution. It should therefore be applied without apology to that moral and noble end, claim our radical elements. Perhaps springing from our Quaker heritage, he asserts, there is the other extreme which believes that never, never, under any circumstances, should one resort to violence, or is it justified? And in between are the vast majority of us who believe that in the right conditions, one man or one society has a right and perhaps even a duty to clobber another. Theologically, I believe this is known as situation ethics. But it is unlikely the mass media will ever reflect one and only one of these views. Moreover, should it agree on the middle and moderate course here, it is even less likely the media's components and practitioners will ever find specific agreement on just when and just where the pole axe ought to fall. Beyond being ambivalent, war has another peculiar trait, which makes nice, tidy reporting of it difficult, if not impossible. Liebling noted it in the subtitle of his article, Molly. After the colon, this gem of a reporter's notebook is called "Confusion is Normal in Combat." Reporting a war or a riot is the classic fable of the blind men describing the elephant. One man can be at one spot at only one time, and what he sees will not be the same as the next guy alone. Thus, historians still argue the fine points of Pickett's charge and ponder the comedy of errors that prompted the conquered farmers to fire across that rude bridge and into His Majesty's redcoat. Confusion is normal in combat, and to expect of those who try to make sense of chaos an instantly neat black and white package of order is surely as naive as Barry Goldwater's 1964 platform. I might suggest that we may be debating Chicago a while, even after Mr. Black's appearance last week. And yet the nature of war, and this one in particular, holds another handicap for those assigned the task of reducing it to words and pictures. The effort of governments to keep out of print all but the sanctioned version. Call it the problem of managed news if your vintage is Kennedy administration, or credibility gap if you prefer the Johnsonian term. Either way, any experienced newsman can vouch for its existence. Experienced newsmen, by the way, are newspaper readers too. And I've seen more than one of them slam down his paper in disgust and say, "Geez, what a slanted story. And now what the blazes does that mean?" Now, just one such scene occurred a couple of seasons back in the editorial offices of the Boston Globe, where I worked in the summer. This was during that period of Vietnam that might best be termed the body count era. And the snorter who slammed down his paper with appropriate oath was Beats Wallace, a fellow laborer in the Wisdom Vineyards. Beats was bugged, it seemed, because a wire service dispatch from the front referred to American casualties in some obscure battle that day as moderate. Our old friend Spokesman had been quoted, by the way. Now, what is moderate and who is Spokesman? And where is the line between light and moderate and heavy in battle casualties? Beats wanted to know, and he handed me this dispatch and suggested that I ought to find out and write an editorial about it. "But who will I call?" I inquired. "Call Robert McNamara," he snarled. And so I did. I put in a person-to-person call for Robert McNamara at the Pentagon. Now, there's an art to placing this kind of call, and I have not fully mastered it, mainly because there's an art to answering such calls. The sweet-voiced artist Mr. McNamara had hired asked the usual questions, and I answered the first one. "And whom shall I say is calling?" In the most important sounding terms, you know. This is where you work it, Dottie, at the chancellor's office sometimes. I could hear her weigh my credentials, but I was not about to tell her what I wanted with the defense secretary. I know all the moves in this game. So did Sweet Boss, of course, and finally... Finally, she had me because it was our nickels and they were mounting. As soon as she knew what I wanted, phase two of Operation Runaround began. "Oh, you want Colonel so-and-so. Would you transfer this car?" 15 minutes later, I'd been bounced through so many bureau drawers, I felt like a mothball lost on a Huff Jim badminton court or something. And, of course, I never got the answer. I got the treatment. And the charade ended in the office of some shoe salesman captain who played palsy-wowsy. "Look, Mac, I'm a Pentagon type. And I don't really know how it's done, but it must be an estimate by one of our intelligence types in the field. Out in the field, dealing with the intelligent types, the battle apparently goes on. Upon his return to this country, David Halberstam and I appeared together on one of those Open Men radio shows in Nashville where you talk a while and then take answers by telephone. Among the more amusing stories that Dave told were those centered on his encounters with our government statesmen, our efforts to smuggle photos and dispatches past Jim's men. On one occasion, he related, he and his colleagues played American football keep-away with some of Madam New's policemen using a camera for the old pigskin. Now we've said the magic word, camera. And I bet you wondered why the visual and the electronic media arrived so late in this discourse. In point of history, too, they've arrived quite late, and some of us remain as ambivalent towards television as Spiegel says the human animal is toward violence. This is not surprising. TV is the new dimension in dealing with Malcolm Brown's new face of war, and we don't yet know quite what to make of it. Our world up to this point has managed to build up a comfortable mythology around what it sees, and now all of this seems to be crumbling. Seeing is believing, says an old aphorism, but somehow it ain't. The camera doesn't lie, goes another, but some of us are beginning to wonder. Our major problem with the visual, it seems to me, is that it has such tremendous emotional impact. Add sound to the screen and many of us become participants, at least emotionally, in the events transpiring many miles away but somehow right before our eyes. The part sound plays in this, by the way, has been underplayed in all the flap about McLuhan and visuals. Researchers have found that sound adds as much and perhaps more to human emotionalism than sight. And if you want to experiment with this in your living room, leave the tube on and close off the audio and see how excited you get. But sight and sound and color together can excite all sorts of moods and emotions. Remember Walt Disney's Fantasia? Way ahead of its time. Ought to bring it back sometime to the Union, Dean. TV, therefore, has given rise to the age of demonstrations, the successful efforts of a relative small bands to gain for an obscure event national or even international attention. Perhaps the most dramatic and extreme example came from Vietnam when the first Buddhist monk reduced himself to a cinder. Malcolm Brown, one of the men we've mentioned, took that ghastly series of pictures, by the way, and AP distributed them worldwide. And Henry Cabot Lodge, then ambassador to Vietnam, wrote in the foreword to Brown's book. Mr. Brown's description of this event and the photographs which he took of it attracted worldwide attention. They also started a wave of thoughts and feelings which unquestionably strengthened the forces which had already put the then government of Vietnam into its terminal phase. Superimpose this kind of impact upon ambivalent violence in its traditional collective form, war, use it live in living room color, and the implications, I suggest, are beyond the full comprehension even of this distinguished forum. While TV's impact in this sort of war reporting has been overpowering, its performance, in my judgment, has been not very good. Another of the major problems beyond this emotionalism that I'm talking about with television is that it grew up in the entertainment business. A firm line has never really been drawn between journalism and showbiz. They still speak of getting the news show on the tube, and that's just what they mean most of the time. Our academic packaging of this phenomenon has been scarcely more satisfying. It is very discomforting to me to realize that in one of our major universities, the counterpart college of which I am here a part is officially known as the College of Communications and Theater. While recognizing the breadth of that term, communications, I was nonetheless a bit rueful this year when we dropped journalism from the official name. There are witnesses to the fact that this TV showbiz notion has carried over into the battlefields of Vietnam. For a short time, one of the newsmen I mentioned here a number of times today, Malcolm Brown, was with one of the networks. He resigned because he said one of the TV's field producers arranged to have a U.S. artillery crew open fire to produce sound effect background for his live reports from the rice paddies. I don't know Mr. Brown, by the way, but I quote you here, him directly from the New York Times. There was a field producer behind me who decided what we needed, that we needed 10 105-millimeter howitzers firing behind me while I talked. Well, we got them. There was no trouble at all. Most field commanders are delighted to provide this kind of backdrop. It seemed to me rather wasteful at the time, especially since it happened that this particular show wasn't used. There must have been, I suppose, maybe $1,000 worth of ammunition shot off for no good reason. Neil Hickey, TV Guide magazine's New York bureau chief, did a series of articles about television's Vietnam correspondence last year and concluded they are a new kind of newsman. I'm quoting him directly. Agglomeration of special traits, ambition, competitiveness, muscle power, adventurousness, perseverance, ingenuity, and pridefulness, tinged in some cases with harmless vanity, for TV newsmen are, after all, part performer. That was meant to be laudatory, I take it. It is nonetheless a bit disturbing to me. Hickey quotes one of the young correspondents. Let's be truthful. We're all war profiteers. We know that if we prove ourselves here, we can shortcut our careers by 5 to 10 years. Here in Vietnam, you can get your face on the network news 3 or 4 times a week. That's more than you can do in the United States. Distortion, some of it unintentional, is another major TV journalism problem encountered in covering all violence and Vietnam in particular. Condensing all the excitement to a tiny time slot has built-in distortion, of course, though this has been improved somewhat by longer news programs, and I'm glad to see that improvement coming. Even so, friends of mine who have been to Vietnam expressed concern with the wide gap between their impressions of the war they saw and what they view at 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock in the evening. Bill Sanders, editorial cartoonist for the Milwaukee Journal, told a group of our students last winter, following his brief sojourn to Vietnam, that he saw a great deal of gap here. The latter, the televised version, he says, with filmed action almost every night, some of the film delayed for several days and shown alongside unrelated news accounts, did not square with the rather casual sort of war he observed. A strange conflict where many of the troops lounged in pressed uniforms on sunny patios sipping beer until it came their turn for one of the search and destroy missions that win the evening TV headlines. From the way Bill described it, the picture much resembled my own familiarity with some of TV's early efforts at showing racial disturbances in the South. A little flurry at one downtown Nashville intersection, aired in the evening on the national nets, would prompt letters from anxious relatives concerning your possible safety. On the positive side, TV's war coverage seems to be arousing increasing interest in Vietnam, and one of the net presidents, ABC's Elmer Lohr, credits the war with forcing TV news analysis, interpretation, and commentary. Last winter, Walter Cronkite made the inevitable trip and came back saying, quote, we are mired in a stalemate. The only rational way out is to negotiate. Frank McGee's comment on NBC was the war is being lost. We must decide whether it's futile to destroy Vietnam in the effort to save it. Neither of these pronouncements is apt to win an Emmy for courage, but at least it's something. To sum up, I would have to call newspaper coverage of Vietnam spotty, heavily chauvinistic at times, but in the main pretty good when one considers the limitations of instantaneous journalism examining the parts of an elephant. If the press was late understanding the implications of the trouble in Southeast Asia, it can at least be said it was no later than most of our politicians and academicians. The earliest press arrivals out there, in fact, seem to have grasped the situation much better and made a much more accurate appraisal of it than the foreign policy men we had on hand. There followed shortly that body count period that we cannot view with particular pride. The major bone I have to pick with newspapers is their tendency, and of course I must generalize, to send a temporary correspondent to Vietnam on a bargain basement budget to gather a bit of color. You know, get some pictures of local boys from Buncombe County, and featureize the war. Glorify it might be a little bit too strong a term, but not much. Another pet peeve is the feature writer tapping out his terse copy and dialogue, whose hero strangely resembles Gary Cooper in Sergeant York. Our subject is almost invariably long and lank, it seems, a circumstance that aggravates short, fat men. He is insufferably modest and therefore answers all questions, yup, and nope, as befits high noon heroes, and then he turns brusquely to more important tasks, you know. The newspaper bright spots would have to include our biggest wire service, Associated Press. I think they've had some fabulous reporters out there, besides Brown, Peter Arnett, and Horst Foss, both of whom won Pulitzers, Hugh Mulligan and Fred Hoffman, who probably deserve one for their disclosures of the graft and corruption in that unhappy land. Some months back, you might recall, Arnett and Foss caught one of our government's propaganda bureaus filming a mock battle. South Vietnamese were being used to play the part of the VC. This may have been, by the way, what prompted AP to put a team of reporters on the effort to determine how much the government itself is spending as a component in our mass media. In TV documentaries that are handed out, in film strips, press releases, pictures, and so forth and so on, the estimate they finally came to was $425 million a year. This may include agriculture bulletins, I don't know, but it still amounts to about $72 million more a year than it costs to operate the legislative and judicial branches combined. It is more than double the combined outlay for news gathering by the two major U.S. news services, the three major television networks, and the 10 biggest American newspapers. No wonder LBJ needed that 10% surtax. Journalistic and opinion magazines, I feel, have done quite a good job with Vietnam. But again, one must generalize. We certainly cannot include Time Magazine's editing of its on-the-spot staffers to reverse the context of their dispatches, a circumstance that caused mass resignations from their Saigon staff. I've been particularly impressed by coverage of the war's effect on the home front. Major pieces like Dan Wakefield's Supernation at War and Peace, done for Atlantic shortly before his semester with us here last spring as a visiting lecturer, and like Calvin Trillin's The War in Kansas for New Yorker. The Sunday supplements on some of our larger metropolitans have also done good work. Like Life and Look, the news weeklies have turned in generally creditable performances, and the book industry has done pretty good. The magazine industry alone, I think, has simply reduced to emptiness any charge that anyone might make that all points of view about Vietnam have not been told and that all the issues have not been explored. I suppose one should say something about radio, but I'm not really certain of its impact in this situation. TV reduced radio to headline news and disc jockeys, some of whom seem to get off a lot of new left cracks, but it's done in such vain that I don't fancy it's having too much effect. Radio does a great job of informing commuters by news capsule between advice on which freeway is jammed with traffic. It also rationalizes a lot of off-the-head opinion from angry listeners by suggesting that this is town hall democracy at work in the age of McLuhan's tribalism. But I don't believe it, and I've heard some terribly irresponsible, unresearched junk by way of the airway. There are still some fine, dedicated newsmen in this field, but they seem to me to be losing the game. TV, as we suggest, remains a source of some dismay, but improving. Now, we speak here of qualitative matters. In terms of quantitative coverage, this is indeed our most thoroughly reported war, and those who do not understand the issues in Vietnam just can't blame the lack of resources. They may rather blame confusing profusion. The media today face the same problems complained of frequently in the academic community. An information explosion, too much to read in too little time, cascades of new facts and more paper to put them on than the wastebasket will contain. One who pursues Vietnam very much will be quickly reminded of the gloomy lament of Ecclesiastes. In much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Well, that brings us full circle. We began here with religion and education. And I'm not at all sure James wasn't right about his conversation stoppers, because war, and this particular war in particular, may be a religious issue. The media, I'm sure, are or ought to be in the business of education. 20 years ago, Robert Hutchins and a panel of academics, recognizing certain common interests with what we shall call the press, issued a report that stirred considerable comment at the time. I recall an observation made by Hutchins in connection with it, and I'm not going to try to give it verbatim, but resort to my own sort of unacademic paraphrase. Everyone is interested in his own rights, but he's not much interested in the other fellows. This includes professors and men in green eye suits. Academic freedom is religion to the prof, but he frequently down deep thinks certain restrictions ought to be put on the media, and he looks down his nose at those who work in such grubby trades. The press, for its part, trumpets press freedom, but leaves a salty, tough guy impression that something really ought to be done about those campus egg brains and fuzzy heretics. The thing both are talking about, of course, is not just press freedom or narrow academic liberty, but free expression. Spoken or written, broadcast or typecast, pulpit or pundit, classroom or newsroom. And maybe one who does not always enjoy it fully can best underscore it for us in the specific context of the media and that war. Michel Gorday of France War, writing in the August 8, 1968, Look magazine, following the Tocquevillian tour of this nation, observed, "During the months I spent in America, a sort of slow landslide had started against the Vietnam War. Every day, every night, newspapers and television brought the war into American homes. Slowly, the well-established idea America has never lost a war was being eroded by free debate and fierce criticism, still the main strength of this nation. The young people were in the forefront, but many elders were in the same fight, and as I went from city to city, from town to town, from home to home, I could see the meaning of that strange slogan, the credibility gap. The mass media, and above all, the impact of television, of the permanent debate on the small screen and on the radio, had created a new political situation, both for the 1968 elections and for the war. As a Frenchman, I know what government-controlled TV and radio can do to misguide a public opinion. On this trip, I saw the definite proof of the vital role of free debate in shaping and changing the mood and even the meaning of patriotism in a great nation. For the past 4 years, I've stood with one foot planted in this academic community and the other in the media. At no time during this period have I discovered that I had one foot in heaven and the other in some medieval gutter. As a matter of fact, I feel fairly level most of the time, though I am known to shift my weight. There are no real reasons for the doubt, antipathy, and dark distrust I frequently feel shuddering beneath my feet. For there is a common bond here, once expressed by some anonymous penman when he philosophized, if all the liberties won by man since the dawn of creation were shackled in chains save one, the freedom of expression, this alone would soon unloose the rest. I hope the day never comes when academics cease to harpoon the media, or when press critics of the universities fall silent, and pray they never crawl into cahoots. But I also hope criticisms will be done with the clear understanding that each, stripped of reason and research and tolerance, is entirely capable of destroying the other, in which event both will fall.